What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But for this week's disinformation slot, we're going to look at how we are lied to with numbers and the risk that we can get data wrong by misinterpreting. And I'm joined now by David Robert Grimes, author and disinformation expert. And David, this is one of those where we can be lied to with information that's technically true.
Absolutely. And it's because the way we interpret information isn't always what the information is telling us. There's always a gap between that. There's lots of examples of this because every day we're accosted with statistics and figures and we think we have an intuitive understanding of them and we often really, really don't.
Well, can I give you an example of this? Because one of the things I always think about is the statistical issue of flight safety, where you think, well, if I've been on several thousand flights, I'm statistically likely to be getting closer to being on an accident flight, whereas the statistical chance of each flight crashing remains consistent.
They remain independent, yeah. So you're committing what's called the gambler's fallacy then. That's when you go to a casino and there's someone rolling it out and saying, well, I've lost every time, so I'm due a win. And there's a confusion there because actually there is a form of logic there. It's just wrong.
Well, this crops up a lot with things like medical prognosis, where you get things that say, if you do X or Y, your risk of cancer or your risk of heart disease increases by 18 or 20%. That can often sound horrifying, but be meaningless.
Yeah, and this is a really good thing. We can jump through an example. I remember in 2015 or 2018, my memory has gone a bit foggy, there was a headline that shocked carnivores the world over that claimed that eating processed meat could increase your risk of cancer, a particular type of cancer, by 18%. 18% is a big sounding figure, right? But the way that was arrived at is that was called a relative risk, right? Which uses a different baseline. So the figure, and we should break this down because it's important, the same information could have been conveyed this way, that over a lifetime, people that ate meat had 1% more cancers than people that didn't eat meat. How can those two figures mean the same thing? Because we use different baselines. In the initial case, they had found that from absolute vegans, 56 people in 1,000 were going to get this cancer in their lifetime. And for people who ate the most amount of processed meat, it was 66 per 1,000, a difference of 10. You can report that two ways. You can report it as a relative risk. And that's the difference between them, that 10 over the lower number, which is 56. That's about 18%. That's a big, scary number. That's a relative risk. But a more accurate way to report that is the absolute risk. How much is my risk increased if I was not a vegan, if I was eating all this meat? And then it's 10 over 1,000. It's a difference over the number of people. That's like 1%. So those two figures meant the same thing. When we see big headlines, things are increasing by this percentage, it's often relative risk we're being exposed to, even though scientific communicators will always tell you you should use absolute risk.
So hang on, let me get this straight. So if I understand this right, boiled down, you're a vegan, I'm a meat eater. If we look at it one way, we can say I am 18% more likely to get cancer by virtue of being a meat eater. If we look at another, we can say you have a 1% cancer rate or cancer chance. I have effectively a 1.2% cancer chance.
Something like that, yeah. And that's where we have to, when we do with statistics, we got to ask what's the baseline? What are we being compared to? I'll give you a more easy to grasp example because that one is a real one, but it always, I give it to my students to bamboozle them because it is a good example. If there's a very rare disease that exists in the population, right, and 1 in 1,000,000 people get this disease, and you have some genetic trait that makes you 2 in 1,000,000 chance that people like you will have that disease, right? Your relative risk is 100% more. You have double the chances of getting that disease, but your chances of getting that disease are still minuscule. The absolute risk is still tiny, tiny, tiny because your denominator is still 1,000,000. Whereabouts in the other case, your denominator is much bigger or much smaller. And this is what confuses us. So oftentimes when we see statistics, we see it with house prices. We know that, and I saw this, I remember, I'm old enough to remember the recession and the slow recovery when house prices fell by 50% from their peak values. And then a few years later, seeing an RTE presenter saying they've gone back up 50%, so they're at the same value they were. Well, no, they're actually at 75% of the value they were because the two baselines were different. When it first fell, you're 100, you'd fell for 50% relative to the initial value. When you go up 50%, you're going up 50% from your new value. The baselines are different. This is not intuitive and it fools us all.
Is this in any way related to survivor bias, the fallacy wherein you take the known set of numbers and ignore all of the others and use them to extrapolate from?
Yeah, that can happen an awful lot. So that's the one that it's really closely related to, and it's sometimes called in this case. There's two. I'm gonna break them down a little bit here, but the one I think you're alluding to there is baseline fallacy, right? And there's a classic example of this during the pandemic, when the vaccines were first rolled out for older people in the UK. There was a shocking headline that the anti-vaccine activists jumped on as a real example of misinformation being used, that 2/3 of all deaths recorded were in vaccinated individuals, right? And this is the over 50 cohort. And they were using that as a gotcha. But they were absolutely wrong to do so, because what they ignored then was that 95% of all people over 50 were vaccinated. So in reality, you had a 5%, the unvaccinated, responsible for 1/3 of all deaths. That's incredibly disproportionate. And if you did the maths right, you'd find out that you had a roughly 10 times greater risk of dying of COVID if you weren't vaccinated, because they didn't look at the baseline. So when I'm trying to work out something, I have to think about that. It's not intuitive. It's very easy to fall victim to it.
You said you were going to separate two out. There was the baseline. What was the other one?
Okay, now you're trying to remember what I've said a few minutes ago. there's a few versions, but what we are bad at is Bayesian and conditional reasoning, right? The other thing, yeah, I'll bring into that. There's conditional reasoning. For example, if you go in, you don't look to me as like an IV drug user, so you're going to be in the low risk category. I mean, you could have if it's a secret you want to tell us, but it's all fine. You go in and get a HIV test, and you're told this test is 99.99% accurate. Technically, if there's any statisticians listening, it's 100% sensitive and 99.99% specific, but let's call it accurate to make things a bit easier. The doctor comes back and says to you, I'm sorry, the test was positive. What is the probability that you actually have HIV based on that test? Intuitively, you're going to think it's probably quite high, right? It's about 50%. How does that make any sense? And let me break it down to you in a way that I think is really important to communicate figures with natural frequencies. What I didn't tell you was the prevalence. About 1 in 10,000 people like you will have HIV. Low-risk people, right, who aren't IV drug users and things like that. If 10,000 people just like you go to get tested, one of them has it, and the test will almost certainly flag them. But in the remaining 9,999, there'll be one poor unfortunate who doesn't have it, who also gets a false positive. But now in that group, you got two positives, only one of which is a true positive. It's 1 in 2, 50%. That is not intuitive at all. And also it changes if you were in a high-risk group. If you were an IV drug user, the baseline rate of HIV is about 1.5%. So if you imagine 10,000 high-risk people going in, 150 of them have it, they'll flag positive, and one in the remaining 9,850 will flag positive by false positive. So now your odds, if you get a positive test and you're high risk, your odds on that being predictive of you having it are 99.37%. This is not intuitive. We all fall victim to this. So statistics look easy until they're not.
Now, this is one of the tricky things about this is we are wired to not just find statistics in the kind of instances that you're describing to find them challenging. We are wired to lean towards the opposite. For instance, if you show somebody a random sequence, they often find it not to look properly random.
Yeah, absolutely. We look for, we're pattern seeking agents, and we like to think there's a nice pattern in everything. And we don't realize what true randomness looks like. I mean, okay, statisticians might sometimes, but even then, our human intuitions absolutely fail us. The one I love giving students is, have you ever come across the Monty Hall problem?
No.
So this is based on a game show, Let's Make a Deal, back in the 1950s. And the premise of this game is really simple. There's three doors.
Oh, is this, yeah, do you stick or do you move? Yes.
Behind two of the doors, there's a goat. And behind one of the doors, there's a sports car. Presumably you want to win the sports car, by the way. This is very important for the premise. So you pick a door, A, B, or C, and the host will open one of the other doors and show you a goat. And then they will say to you, do you want to switch your choice or do you want to stay with your choice? And the question you would ask people is, should you stay or should you switch?
And the natural tendency is to believe one has a goat, one has a door, it's 50-50, it makes no difference.
It is always better to switch. It's 2/3 to 1/3. That's not intuitive, but the way you can do it is you can write it down and write every possibility out and things like that. But this was a really famous problem because in Parade magazine years ago, Marilyn Von Savant, who was, I think, the smartest woman in the world.
And she got castigated.
She got castigated for correctly giving the answer. So she gave the correct answer and people got so kind of misogynistically bent out of shape at her. I write about it a lot in my book, The Irrational Ape, because I think this is a great story. But it shows us that we...
But it wasn't just that people castigated her. As I understand, I think...
mathematics professors.
And some of them had to do grovelling apologies subsequently.
They did, and so they should have, because the way you could do it is a payoff matrix. There's a lot of ways you can do that. But again, when you write it down, it becomes quite clear. The problem is if I say things to you like that very quickly, if I'm, for example, trying to mislead you, I can do all sorts of things. I can take a figure in isolation and go, immigration is raised by, you know, 150%, which might be huge. But if your baseline figure was tiny, 150% of a tiny number, it wouldn't be a big increase. So we often see this in misinformation and disinformation, people grabbing a statistic or a soundbite out of isolation and throwing it out there. And the question we need to always ask is, what are you comparing that to and where are you getting that from?
What about sample size? Because I'm always intrigued by ads that say 45% of people found an improvement. And then at the bottom it says...
prefer this.
Yeah, and it says sample size 43 people. You know, does that work?
No, probably not, is the honest answer. Sample size is really important in statistical theory for a few different reasons. The larger your sample is, you reduce your variability. And what that means in lay terms is your estimate, your point estimate of what your percentage is going to be far more accurate and less likely to be affected by outliers. So, for example, when we do national polling, for a few years, I won't go into the maths, I'll spare you that because you look already kind of concerned. But when you're doing polling, you usually see a margin of error around 3% for a sample size of 1,000. And that's a fairly standard calculation to arrive at that. But there's ways of refining that, but to make that margin of error smaller and smaller, you get diminishing returns as your sample size gets bigger because it's to the square root of it. But that's a boring bit of detail I'll leave out. But what's really, really important about that is small samples can mislead you. If I, for example, decided I was going to measure the average height of men in Ireland and I went to a basketball court and measured 50 people there, I might be misleading myself because I've used a small sample size that's going to be skewed by outliers.
What then about sampling where significance isn't taken into account? Take those advertisements that say kills 99% of germs and viruses. That's wonderful, but if in the 0.1% is Ebola, it could be a problem. What about those where the claim may be true, but the downside number carries unmentioned significance?
Well, there's lots of examples of that in real life. For example, I always used to joke when I was giving public talks on vaccination, I would say things like, 100% of people who got the smallpox vaccine in the 1800s are dead now. Yeah, it's obviously misleading, but it's true. So you can still give something that's true, but it's not necessarily relevant. So one of the questions you often would ask of a statistic is that relevant? Is that actually informative, or is that just a big number? And this goes back to the same thing we said with the relative risk. We see the big number and we go, ooh, but really the question is, what are you telling me? And in some ways, used properly, statistics are very good at helping us understand the world. Used improperly, there's a quote that I love that statistics are, you know, politicians use statistics in the way a drunk uses a lamppost, for support rather than illumination. And there's a level of that. But I mean, I will say, I mean, again, I'm a statistician, so I feel I have to say this, that they can be incredibly informative, but people have to ask the question, what are you comparing to what? Because they are a method of comparison.
Are people who aren't statisticians equipped to ask that question?
I think so, broadly. And I think the way to do it, obviously, is the minutiae is going to be the dancing on a head of a pin stuff we don't have to worry about. But the general question is, if someone gives you a figure, you go, okay, but you got to remember there's a baseline. If I'm saying there's a percentage increase or decrease, what are we comparing that to? And I would often say, and I say this to young science communicators when I talk to them, always use absolute risk. For example, it's much less likely to mislead. If we were talking about our red meat and cancer thing there, we should use our straight percentages. How much is the absolute risk increase? Because the relative risk is always going to be much bigger and sound much scarier. Unfortunately, newspapers and social media love the scary big figure. And this happens, for example, I get asked all the time about, let's say, breast cancer and drinking. And people, well, I've heard how much of that risk goes up and down. And it's actually quite modest. Over a lifetime, it's incredibly modest. But because people see big figures like, oh, it's a 30% increase in risk, they don't realize that's 30% relative to a relatively low baseline figure. under very certain circumstances, and it's very easy to get bamboozled.
David, as ever, thank you very much. David Robert Grimes, author and disinformation expert.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.